Welcome to Commons and Chronicles, the podcast where we talk about all the best Creative Commons and reusable open game license content. If you need resources for your creative writing, game design, or you just love lore, Commons and Chronicles is for you. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu, and in this episode I wanted to continue what I started way back in episode 2, which is the examination of H.P. Lovecraft's Dreamland realm. Now, the Dreamland realm is I guess best described in his work The Dream Quest for Unknown Caedith, and it's arguable that that work expounds upon a lot of his other mythos, I guess, because it does it for instance pulls in Nyarlathotep, it pulls in Azathoth. It's got a lot of references to other things that Lovecraft talks about in other stories. So in a way, this is kind of the fantasy setting for his universe, for his world that he built. And he refers to it as the Dreamlands in this book, the Dream Quest for Unknown Caedith, although he writes in the voice of Carter, the protagonist, about how the waking life is actually a dream, and that the Dreamlands are reality. So it's not super clear as to what he intended, I don't feel, about where or how real the Dreamlands are. And yet in the Dreamlands there are talks about these other Dreamlands, Dreamlands within Dreamlands, and the fact that you might encounter something in the Dreamlands that no one else has encountered there because it's part of your own personal dream. So there is an intimation that it isn't 100% real. And there's also even a mention later that if you wake up from your time in the Dreamlands, if you return to the waking world, you might forget the things that you dreamt about. So there's a lot of conflicting message there. There's a little bit of a mixed signal, and you can untangle that yourself as you build your own campaign within this world, whether you want to treat it very much as a dream, i.e. a place that you go to when you fall asleep, or something maybe even involuntary like the Fade in Dragon's Age, if you've ever played that video game, or maybe you want to treat it as reality, the real actual campaign setting of your adventure, and maybe part of the method of traveling between realms is that you can fall asleep and dream of another realm, whatever. I think there's a lot of room here for interpretation, because it's not very, very clear as to what Lovecraft intended, and it's probably arguable that he couldn't have cared less. He didn't need to clarify exactly how one reaches these dreamlands and the tangibility or not intangibility of the dreamland realm. To that end, I generally refer to this setting when I use it in my games as the Six Kingdoms, because that avoids a lot of the confusion about, well, why are we calling it the Dreamlands if we're not asleep while we're here? So calling it the Six Kingdoms harkens to a phrase that H.P. Lovecraft uses in The Dream Quest for Unknown Caedith when he states that something is unique among all the Six Kingdoms. So he refers to the realm as the Six Kingdoms, he just doesn't specify what those kingdoms are. I could think of probably around 4 proposals of what those kingdoms might be, but since Lovecraft didn't say it explicitly, I will refrain from throwing around ideas in that way. So in this episode today, I want to talk about the underworld of the Six Kingdoms of the Dreamland realm. The underworld of any fantasy setting, I feel, is pretty important to cover, because it's the antithesis, it's the evil thing, it's the place where a lot of those monsters are crawling out from. At least, you know, the evil monsters, not the monsters that you just find roaming around the countryside doing monster things that just happen to involve trampling or eating or attacking travelers, but the actual, like, abominations, they generally come from the underworld. And in a game called Dungeons and Dragons, for instance, it's important to consider that dungeons are underground, and so they may intersect a little bit with these underground realms, these underworlds. Of course, the underworld in popular mythology is usually not a physical place. It's not something that you could just dig really, really deeply into and then end up in Hades or whatever your underworld is. But I think in Dungeons and Dragons and in fantasy and in mythology even, there's some crossover point when you're going underground where you kind of cross from mundane digging and mining down to the true otherworldly depths. And that's basically what the underworld in the Dreamland realms are like. They are physical places that you can reach just by going deep down enough underground. But we are talking about very deep, unfathomable depths. That said, there are two explicitly named entrances to the underworld in the Dream Quest for the Unknown Caedith. And I don't think this excludes places where dwarves could have dug very deep, or where you might run into the underworld by entering a tomb and going maybe too far down or whatever. It's just that these are the two places that were named explicitly in the story, because they served a narrative purpose. One such place is the sealed tomb in the Enchanted Woods, which you may remember from episode 2. So in the Enchanted Woods, where it borders the countryside, which we talked about in episode 2, there was a clearing, and in the clearing there was a very large stone door with a 3-foot-wide iron handle on it, an iron ring on it. And it is explicitly said that the Zoogs, the rat-like creatures that inhabit the Enchanted Woods, avoid that clearing, you know, kind of scamper past it very quickly because they fear what might be kept within it. Now, this is a little bit of a spoiler, so if you plan on reading the Dream Quest of the Unknown Caedith, maybe you don't want to know this. It's not a huge spoiler, it's a tiny spoiler. But the sealed, this great stone door does not actually contain a sealed tomb, which is what the Zoogs suspected. But it actually is a passage to the upper floor of a great tower, the Tower of Koth, which resides in the kingdom, an underground kingdom of some giants that live underground. So that's one place where the overworld and the underworld intersect very directly. Now, you might wonder why the underworld doesn't just come streaming out of this portal, this door. And the reason is that, first of all, most of the underworld creatures cannot open this door. It's just too heavy for them, in other words. And the second one, the other reason, those that could are not able to leave the underworld through this portal because there's a curse from one of the gods that protects the upper world from the underworld, at least through this portal. It's not explicitly said that there are no other portals. In fact, it's explicitly said, I guess, that there are other portals that some creatures go through, but at least the giants within that kingdom cannot, due to a curse from a god, exit their kingdom through that door into the overworld. So the other intersection of the underworld, or the other passage to the underworld through the Dreamlands, are some caverns in a mountain called Granik, which is located on the island of Oriab. Now, we haven't been to the island of Oriab yet, in this podcast, I mean, and we will get there later. It's a very large, important island, sort of east, in the eastward along the Southern Sea. And in the previous episode, episode 2, we ended our tour at Dilith Lean. The Southern Sea is a big place, and it's just got a lot of different cultures along it. And while it's very interesting to hear about, it's a lot of information, and I felt like the underworld was a little bit more concentrated, so I wanted to cover that first. So we'll get to the Southern Sea, we'll get to Oriab, but for now, just know that Oriab is a very large island in the Southern Sea, and that it is the home of a great mountain called Granik. And in the mountains of, in the passes of Granik, there are caverns, and if you go down those caverns far enough, you will reach the underworld. The underworld itself is a vortex of shrieking and demonic madness. Its air is tomb-like, and it is lit by a gray, phosphorescent death fire. That's what Lovecraft calls it, a death fire. And it hovers, apparently, in mid-air. And from this death fire, which lights many regions of the underworld, but at the same time, the death fire emits a dank kind of stale mist, which I think helps obscure the death fire from other places, because it is stated that other places in, you know, some regions of the underworld are complete darkness, and then others are not. So I'm assuming that these mists help create sort of a cloud cover, really, over part of the underworld. If you descend into the underworld from the caverns in Mount Granik, then you will find yourself, I think, typically in the peaks of Throck. Now, the way that you would get through these caverns and down into Throck, you would not survive a fall. You would have to use some kind of spell like Featherfall to slow your rate, or you'd have to have something fly you down. The things that will fly you down are not necessarily pleasant, and since they're not specifically of the underworld, I'm not going to talk about them in this episode. I'm going to save them for the episode about Oriab and about Mount Granik itself, because that's really their domain, and the fact that they go into the underworld in the book, in the quest, in the dream quest for Unknown Caedith, is more down to sort of a mission that they've been given, rather than because they hang out in the underworld. So if you go down, anyway, one way or another, through these caverns, you'll find the Peaks of Throck. Now, the Peaks of Throck are impossibly high and dangerous mountains. It's a mountain range that extend from the depths of the underworld towards the overworld. As far as we know, they don't ever intersect. We do know that the mountains are just impossibly high. They're very, very tall, and that kind of speaks to the depths involved within the underworld. It's once again, it is impossibly deep, the underworld. You have to travel a long way to get there. At the bottom of the Throck Mountains are the Pnoth Valleys, P-N-O-T-H. These are the home to the evil Dols, D-H-O-L-E, Dols. Dols are a burrowing, crawling creature that feasts on pretty much anything that is alive. Dols are known only by dim rumor, since no one who's ever seen one has actually lived to talk about it. And it is known that they make a great rustling when they move amongst mountains of bones that gather around their homeland, and they're slimy to the touch. That's mostly all that we know about them. They also dwell in utter darkness. The valleys of Panoth are very dark, both by the shadows created within them by the peaks of Throck, as well, I assume, by the mists that are coming off of the gray phosphorescent death fires that are mentioned as part of the lighting system of the underworld. So we don't have a whole lot of information about the Dulls. There is a Dull that we get to sort of encounter in the story, in the book, the Unknown Caedith book, but it's more of a sound and urgency is what it is. So we don't really have what I would call a close encounter necessarily. A little bit difficult, I guess, to imagine, based on what Lovecraft writes, what exactly a Dull would look like, or what its stats would necessarily be. And I looked around to see if anyone had come up with stats for a Dull, and so far I couldn't find one, at least not as of right now. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. There's a lot of material out there. But one of the things that does exist is a dog mole and a dog mole juggernaut. And if you get the Tome of Beasts by Kobold Press, you could get those stats for yourself. I mean, they're open game license. I could read them here, but it's not all that interesting to hear. Just stats being read out. But it is kind of a cool two creatures, the dog mole and the dog mole juggernaut. And I can really kind of see, with some exceptions, I mean, the picture in the book specifically has a dog mole being pretty hairy, and Lovecraft says specifically that these are slimy to the touch. So you would have to just kind of, you know, modify that a little bit, for the purpose of a Dull. But I think that the spirit is basically the same. It's kind of, there are these large burrowing creatures that are quite ferocious. They can burrow, they can go into rages, they can do multi-attacks with bites and fangs and so on. Now, interestingly, these Dulls are able to climb ladders, because at one point, again, this is a little bit spoilery, but at one point the protagonist is climbing up some man-made structure. Okay, it's a ladder. Is climbing up a ladder, and a Dull, or what we assume is a Dull, we have no reason to believe it's not a Dull, starts following him up the ladder. So it's probable that they have prehensile paws, which, again, if you look at the picture of the dog mole in the Tome of Beasts by the Kobold Press people, they just have huge claws almost instead of paws, so I can't really imagine them necessarily climbing up ladders. So some modification would be required, a little boost in dex maybe, although actually their dex is pretty good, so you wouldn't really, you know, just ignore the picture is what I'm trying to say. But it's a great stat block, and if you check out Tome of Beasts, I'll put a link to it in the show notes, that would be a fantastic stat block for the Dulls, I think. Okay, so on some plateaus of Throck, the mountains, these high mountains, there are populations of ghouls. Ghouls are an undead, cannibalistic incarnation of people who were once living, as most undead things are. But it's you could be someone who died and then sort of ended up in the Dreamland realm as a ghoul, or you could have journeyed into the Dreamland realm and then died there. Not super explicit as to how you become a ghoul, but there is a rather prominent character in the source text who is a ghoul, who lived in Boston. He was an artist in Boston and is now a ghoul in the Dreamland realm. So it's something that you can become from reality. You can end up in the Dreamland realm as a ghoul. So the ghouls have almost canine-like faces and greenish rubbery flesh. They're scavengers mostly. They dwell in filth. They come up from the grave, so they hang around the graveyards a lot, usually for food. And that's kind of what they do. If a ghoul dies, then other ghouls will eat the dead ghoul. As I say, they're cannibalistic. So they're a pretty rough lot, but not I wouldn't say that they were. They're not like zombies or anything. They're not antagonistic. They simply, they're scavengers. They're a little bit like vultures in a sense that they will eat things that have just died, and they will eat each other if someone else has, you know, if one of them, their own, has died. They hang around graveyards, and they're just all around creepy. They are full of decay. They dwell in filth, and they lose a lot of intelligence when you know, in the process of becoming a ghoul. They speak ghoulish or ghoulese or whatever you would call their language. It's certainly not specified in the text, but it's a series of what is described as meeps. It's M-E-E-P, meeps. So I gather they must have some kind of vocal capacity, but it's mostly just moans and whines. Now, some of them are able to remember the language that they spoke in life, but not well. So they can communicate in common sometimes, but a lot of times it's rudimentary. It's not uncommon for ghouls from the dreamland realm to appear in the waking world, again, especially in graveyards. So they tend to traverse that breach between the two realms fairly often, from what I gathered. So ghouls have stat blocks, as you might expect, and you can find ghoul stats in several different bestiaries. My favorite one, though, I think, is the beggar ghoul. In the Tome of Beasts, again, by Kobold Press. And the beggar ghoul is not a super powerful creature. It's armor class of 12, hit points is 13, speed is 30, so they're sort of just a person, really, except, you know, they're a ghoul. Their language is given as undercommon in the Tome of Beasts, which I think that sounds pretty good. They've got things like dark vision, which is, yeah, definite alignment into the Lovecraft stuff. Passive perception boosts of 10. They are immune to poison and the charmed condition and to exhaustion. And all of that seems pretty spot on with Lovecraft as well, actually. They can bite, they can claw, and they're pretty intelligent, really. I mean, they're not super intelligent in this Tome of Beast stat block. They're 12 intelligence, 11 wisdom, 14 charisma. And that, again, it sounds pretty much spot on. In Lovecraft's source text, his ghouls are, I mean, there's a society, it's a social, you know, they're social creatures. They hang out together, they coordinate, they form sort of a little militia at one point. So they use tools and they wield weapons. So yeah, they're really non-zombified undead, essentially, is what they are. So in the Tome of Beasts, they are given the classification of chaotic evil, which you would have to modify, because in Lovecraft they're definitely not chaotic evil. They're much more neutral, I would say. I mean, you could maybe align them with evil in some way, like lawful evil or something, but really they're quite neutral. They are the scavengers of their ecosystem, essentially. They eat creatures, they throw bones down the mountainside, and that's it. Now, they're not super friendly to everyone. They end up being friendly to the protagonist of the Unknown Caedith book because he knew one of the ghouls from reality, from Earth, from Boston. So he has essentially a friend already within the ghoul community and is able to get favors done by other ghouls because of his connection. Even so, I never got the impression that he would have been necessarily threatened by the ghouls were it not for the fact that he had a connection within the ghoul community. I just got the feeling that they would have probably ignored him because he's not dead yet, and that's that. So those are the ghouls, and again, that's Tome of Beasts if you want a stat block for that. Oh, and one more thing that's really good about the Tome of Beasts for this is that there are several stat blocks for other kinds of ghouls. So, I mean, in terms of being true to the source material, I think the beggar ghoul is the most like what was described in the book. But since it is a society, and there is some variation mentioned, I mean, for instance, this guy from Boston who the protagonist knew, who became a ghoul, is a little bit different from the other ghouls. He seems to be a little bit of a leader. He knows common a little bit better. So there's this impression that he's kind of less ghoulish than the others. Although it is, I mean, a ghoul is still a ghoul, but he's a little bit less of a ghoul. So I think that it's reasonable to think, well, okay, maybe there is some variation in the ghoul society, even within Lovecraft's world. And sure, he may not have imagined it exactly like this, but there are about five or six different kinds of ghouls in the Tome of Beasts from Kobold Press. There's the Beggar Ghoul, the Bone Powder Ghoul, the Darakul Ghoul, which is really cool looking, sort of a almost like a mage ghoul or a wizard ghoul, and yeah, just wearing this really cool sort of Macintosh coat. It's super cool, really. Just look at the art if you get a chance to look at this book ever. The Emperor Ghoul and the Imperial Ghoul, which is kind of a guardsman ghoul, and an Iron Ghoul, which is sort of your foot soldier kind of ghoul. So lots of different ghouls to choose from. And like I say, in the Lovecraft source material, there comes about eventually a little bit of a battle between the ghouls and some other creatures that we'll talk about in a later episode, which I don't want to talk about yet. I'm trying to keep my episodes as spoiler-free as possible, and they get more spoilery as they go along for this one, so that if I'm trying to buy you time, in other words, to go read the Dream Quest of the Unknown Caedith. So anyway, I'm not going to talk about who they're fighting. I'm just going to say that they are fighting, so it's reasonable to assume that there are different kinds of ghouls, different levels of ghoul soldiering and warfare and so on. And I think that Tome of Beasts from Kobold Press touches on a lot of great ideas for a whole ghoul society. So the other entry into the underworld I've mentioned is the big iron or stone door with the iron, the 3-foot wide iron ring on it. And this leads down, I said, to a great big tower called the Tower of Koth, which is it's in the center of the kingdom of the Gugs. G-U-G, Gugs. Gugs are hairy giants who once reared stone circles in the enchanted wood and made strange sacrifices to the other gods and the crawling chaos near Lothotep, until one night an abomination of theirs reached the ears of Earth's gods, and they were banished to caverns below. So the Gugs used to be overworld creatures, and are now banished to the underworld, and the Earth gods have placed a curse upon the great stone trap door within the enchanted wood, making it impossible for the Gugs to come back up to the overworld. Gugs live in great cities, giant cities. They're giants. So they live in giant cities within an underground Gug kingdom. In the center of their kingdom is the Tower of Koth. It is denoted by the sign of Koth inscribed upon it, and this leads up to the stone trapdoor, ultimately, which leads to the upper world. So it's not really specified how high up all of this stuff goes, but I imagine the tower needs to be pretty tall to get to bridge that gap to the upper, to the overworld. Because even though the protagonist of the book climbs up to meet the ghouls, and the ghouls take him to the kingdom of the Gugs, I don't think that they would be that close to the overworld. You know, I don't think this is a short tower, in other words. And it is a giant tower as well, so the steps are accordingly gigantic. You can do it, but they're quite large. So the Gugs used to feast on human flesh. That was what they really enjoyed eating. But since they've been banished to the underworld, where human flesh is pretty limited, their diet has been limited mostly to the flesh of ghasts. They fear ghouls, or at least they fear them enough. When they see them in a graveyard, they'll kind of avoid them. They'll avoid the ghouls very, you know, they'll give them a respectful, wide berth. But a ghoul, like if a ghoul wanders into their cities, that would be considered a threat, and they would try to destroy the ghoul or at least drive it away. Gugs are gigantic and I guess ostensibly human-like. They have talons, great talons, and they have a mouth that opens vertically rather than horizontally. Its fangs are enormous and razor sharp. They're definitely probably a lawful evil type of creature. They're pretty mean creatures, actually. And there is a stat block for them, amazingly, in, once again, the Kobold Press Tome of Beasts. This is a great book, obviously, and I was really surprised to find a Gug within its pages. I was really, really happy. And it was, you know, I'd checked several other books. I'd checked Monster Manual, I'd checked the Pathfinder Bestiary, at least the Bestiary 1, and I'd checked a Green Ronin Monsters and Foes book. And then I turned back to the Tome of Beasts, and there it is, the Gug, the literal Gug from Lovecraft is right there. It's a really good stat block. It's a huge, oh, here it is, actually, huge, giant, neutral evil is what they classified it as. Its armor class is 17, so it's kind of hefty. Hit points 270, so not going to be easy to kill. They're pretty dumb, intelligence of 10, wisdom of 8, but yeah, constitution 25, strength 24, so it's not, they're definitely dangerous creatures. They have immunities to poison, they have condition immunity to confusion, exhaustion, paralysis, and poison. Their senses include really, really good dark vision, up to 240 feet, really good passive perception. They have, let's see, languages are listed as deep speech, giant, and undercommon. And they have a couple of interesting traits. One of them is that they prey on ghouls, which, once again, is pretty accurate to the Lovecraft stuff. Again, like the ghouls in Lovecraft, and the Gugs and the ghouls in Lovecraft kind of avoid one another, actually. So I wouldn't say that Gugs necessarily prey upon the ghouls, but I do think that that's something to keep in mind, that they don't like them, and if a ghoul wanders into their city, it will be attacked by a Gug. Gugs can stomp, they can slam, they can grab, they can swallow, and they can throw. So they have lots of interesting actions that they could do to your players. So check out the Tome of Beasts, again, by Kobold Press for the full Gug stat block. If you haven't gotten the message yet, the Tome of Beasts from Kobold Press is absolutely a great purchase. It is an amazing bestiary. It's one of my favorites. So anyway, those are the Googs. The Googs are basically ferocious underworld giants. That's what they are. And they are, as I said, neutral evil, so watch out for them. The other aspect of the underworld that we get from the book are the Vaults of Zin. Z-I-N. The Vaults of Zin are a cave system in the underworld, so it's a dungeon within a dungeon, I guess, or a dungeon within the underworld, really. And at least one of the exits of the Vaults of Zin leads to the kingdom of the Googs. And so this exit is guarded by a Goog. The reason it is guarded by a Goog is because in the Vaults of Zin there are these creatures called Ghasts. G-H-A-S-T-S. Ghasts. Ghasts are malicious creatures about the size of a small horse. They leap around on long hind legs, I guess a little bit like a kangaroo. The legs are compared to those of a kangaroo in the book. They have faces, though, that are very human-like, although they lack... They don't have, like, a nose, and they don't have much of a forehead, but they are human-like. And they're, like I say, they're fairly large creatures. They're about the size of a small horse. Their paws are large, with even larger claws, and they attack their prey with great speed, ferocity, and usually as a pack. They can live only in darkness. They actually die when exposed to light. Now, I don't know how much light it requires to kill a ghast. It's not super explicit, and they do come out to attack this a Goog at one point in the story. And it is said that it is not completely dark in this area, so there must be some light, but it's probably that death fire thing that lights up the entire underworld, so maybe that light is more tolerant to them than, for instance, something like sunlight would be. Either way, Ghasts prefer the darkness, and I don't really have any stats on them. I wasn't able to decide what kind of creature exactly I would equate them to, or otherwise what kind of stats I would you know even begin to give them. It's kind of up in the air, I think, and that's partly because it's just down to the fact that I'm not 100% sure of what exactly they are. Frankly, it's a puzzling creature, the Ghasts. I feel like I mostly get what they're supposed to be, but it's kind of difficult to pin it down, and I think in a way I kind of keep wanting to make them sort of lizard folk slash kobolds, you know, something sort of lizardy and subterranean and. But beastly, I guess, you know, something sort of a cross between a lizard folk and I guess a really evil kangaroo. But it's difficult for me to picture exactly what Lovecraft had in mind. And there's probably some really great artwork out there of what a ghast could look like, and going off of that artwork, probably some cool stats could be invented, but I was not able to come up with anything that I felt super comfortable about putting anywhere yet. So maybe in the future I'll get around to it. But that's what they are. They're horse-sized, malignant kangaroos with human faces, and hopefully claws, and hopefully they look really evil and not comical. So those are a little bit tough, I think, the Ghasts. But they're at eternal war with the Googs. The Googs do not like Ghasts, and Ghasts do not like Googs. And to such a degree that the Googs guard their own settlement from Ghasts. They do fear them. They kill them with extreme prejudice. Okay, so that's the underworld of the Dreamland Realm from Lovecraft that is pretty much everything that was written about the underground realm or the underground territories beneath the Dreamlands. Functionally, it's a place where evil creatures either flourish or have been banished, and it's kind of the refuse heap of much of the world. So, you hear about bones and things that are being discarded will find their way down to the underworld, and there they lie, or there they are devoured, or whatever their fate may be. So that's what happens in the underworld. So it isn't, for instance, something horrible and completely terrible like the Underdark of Dungeons and Dragons of Forgotten Realms. But it's an evil place. It is a place where evil can crawl from. It's a place where old forgotten horrors can come to light, or at least emerge from and then come to light. And I think it's fleshed out just enough. You do have a kingdom down there. You've got the kingdom of the Gugs, so there could be other kingdoms down there. Certainly, there could be drow, there could be kobolds, there could be any variety of typically underground things down there. And then above the underworld, of course, I can imagine there being the mines, the typical mines of the dwarves. Maybe if your gnomes are subterranean, there could be gnomes down there somewhere. And of course, if anyone goes too deeply, then they find themselves opening a portal into the underworld, and who knows what kind of evil comes from. I'll close out this episode with a quick little story, inconsequential story, about a gaming convention that I recently was serving as a dungeon master for. It was a 3 or 4 hour game that I was preparing for, and I'd prepped a dungeon, as you do for those quick one-off games. And there were a couple of people who came to the game, to the room, a little bit early. One was an experienced gamer, and one was a rather new gamer. And the new gamer, to my surprise, must have read every rule book and every source book available, and asked me right away what the setting was, and where, what the nearest largest city was. And I hadn't prepared for that because I really was just gonna do a dungeon dive. That's for in 3 hours. That's kind of all you have time for. So I thought, well, I have no idea what to tell this person. So first thing on my mind was the Dreamland realm. So I said, oh, this is a setting in the Six Kingdoms, in Ulthar, just outside of Ulthar. And of course, he didn't know what that was, and that's fine. Didn't need to, really. I mean, that was my point. But then when we started the game, we started to I sort of sent them towards the dungeon straight away, because again, 3 or 4 hour game, that's really all you have time for. And to my surprise, the experienced gamer, who I kind of had thought, well, this is an experienced gamer, he'll know what we're all in for. It's a short game. It'll be understood that the beginning point is the dungeon, and that's what we'll do, and we'll just go into the dungeon. Of course, that never works out. And so the experienced gamer right away asked, well, is there a village nearby that we could do some reconnaissance in, kind of get some information about this dungeon before we just dive right in? I thought, sure, there is. There's a city. It's called, as I have already had said to the new gamer, I said, it's called Ulthar. And so I got to run a little bit of a campaign in Ulthar before they finally got around to delving into this dungeon, which of course ended up being a tomb, an old forgotten tomb to the old god Sish. And it was a lot of fun. It was great. These places work fantastic as campaign settings. And when writing down campaigns for any kind of publication, it's just so nice to be able to look at something and give some some specifics about the surrounding area without having to be really, really vague because you're trampling on someone else's copywritten or non-open map. And when you have your own setting, something that's freely available to you, you're able to just say, you know, here's the tomb. The closest city is this city here. There's a river that runs down that way. And if you go further west, then you'll run into the Enchanted Wood, and so on. So it is super, super handy, and it has been very handy to me as someone who enjoys running a game in an open world. And by open world, I mean open source world, rather than necessarily an open world, although when you have this great big open source content world, then you also, I think, by its very nature of everything being defined, you can say it's open world, because it now becomes open world. There are no directions that your players can turn that have not been accounted for. So it's a lot of fun. Just thought I'd share that. Thank you very much for listening to Chronicles and Commons, and I will talk to you next time. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as not Klaatu. I'm on the Freenode network. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.